Well, a happy April 2021 to all of you out there in Blog Talk Radio land. This is Mike Galliano coming to you from the sadly very rainy Seattle, Washington area. It's actually been glorious the last few days, and so we pay for that now with 2 or 3 days of rain to knock the pollen down, I guess. There's the positive. I do hope that this finds you all well. Since we last talked to you, I think we were, gosh, I think it goes so fast now. I think we chatted with you folks in February, and time flies by pretty quick. The older I get, the faster it goes. But we are excited to be with you. We're very honored that you would spend time with us. I promise you, we're going to do our best to give you some stuff you can really use tonight and some stuff that will make your job easier. And interesting, at least for a lot of us, our topic tonight is it's kind of low-rep stuff. We don't do it enough, I feel like, to just get really good at it. It's not bread and butter for a lot of us in operations. And so very cool to get one of the leading figures, the leading lights on just what to do on first-in hazmat ops on the show today. And we'll bring him in a bit, but let's jump across from the wild and wacky weird West Coast all the way over to what I hope is at least a little bit saner version of our country over to the East Coast. And the humble confines of Long Island, New York, my brother, Michael Dugan. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, thanks, bro. It's good to be here, as always. Looking forward to a discussion tonight over something that I confess I was never very good at, and something that scared the heck out of me. It's kind of like hazmat to me is like electricity. I can't really see it all the time. I'm not sure all the time. And then when you feel it, sometimes it's too late. So I think it's a good thing for the guys and the girls in operations to be aware of these things. And I think it's something that we'll have a lot of fun with. And very honestly, it was 68 degrees here today and a beautiful spring day. And we're getting your rain over all weekend. We're getting it Sunday. But that's okay. It's not snow. I was an optimist today. And I took the snowball and put it in the storage shed. So hopefully we're done with that for the year.
Hey, you know, brother, you just screwed over everybody in your neighborhood. There's a blizzard coming now. You did it.
Yeah, well, I think it's 68. If it gets close to 70, I think you're pretty good. So.
Yeah, man. Yep. 68 sounds glorious. Mm, that sounds really good.
Oh,
we're
glorious.
Probably a month. We're a month away from that, but that's all right. Well, Mike, before we start, I did just want to make a quick mention, and you can probably speak to this even more authentically than I can, but we did hear, I heard it through our editor, Diane Rothschild, that Janet Kimmerly, who was editor and longtime editor of WNYF magazine, passed away. And from this coast, Mike, I can tell you, as I'm from the moment I got on the job, especially in Seattle Fire, I've been on the lookout for stuff to help build up the craft. And Seattle Fire provided some of that, certainly a lot of that. But I didn't stop there, and I was always on the lookout for insight and information and tips on tactics and leadership, trying to find it wherever I could find it. And certainly in the pages of WNYF magazine, I found that. And read some of your stuff, Michael, along the way, as you're probably aware. But I just wanted to, on behalf of our radio show, I just wanted to tip our cap. You know, the people who edit the magazines and do that stuff, it's behind the scenes. It doesn't get a lot of praise. And I just wanted to, just a quick salute to somebody whose hard work and effort impacted me all the way across the coast and built into the foundation of my journey to try to some way, somehow get better at this craft and learn from the people who were actually doing it. Mike, so let me pass that on to you.
Yeah, and Janet passed away, unfortunately, of COVID from what I've been told, which is pretty scary. She wasn't that much older than I was, and it's a scary thing. And the other thing that is really sad is Janet was a volunteer and a member of the Port Washington Fire Department for 20 plus years. as a volunteer in Port Washington. So she not only did the magazine, but she walked in the same shoes that we did in some instances. So Godspeed, Janet.
Yeah, on behalf of our show, salute to you for a job well done, and I would hope this would serve as an encouragement to every one of you out there who is working away, doing your stuff. There's nobody pinning medals on your chest. There's nobody writing articles or naming training towers after you or all the other things that I think we identify sometimes with people who are just doing a really good job. There is a bunch of you, and as a matter of fact, most of you out there. You're not going to get a tremendous amount of accolade. You're not going to get a tremendous amount of acknowledgement or recommendation. But, man, for all that's holy, Janet stands as a shining example of that. You are impacting people. You are having a dramatic, dramatic change effect on men and women all across this country and certainly within your own jurisdiction with the things that you do both on and off shift, whether it's going to fires or whether it's just going to swing by after shift and help out that old lady who needed the stairs repaired, work, all the different things that are done in training and what have you. I just want it to serve as an encouragement to you, and I think Janet stands as a real testimony to that. I can speak from great experience. I didn't know her, but I can tell you what, her work impacted me, and it impacted me greatly, and I'm grateful and I appreciate it. So Janet, salute. In that vein, Michael and I are going to do what we always try to do. We're going to try to bring to you someone who is amongst the brightest and the best in our nation. Many of you may know him. Many of you may not. The unfortunate thing with a lot of the folks that we bring on here, we got a lot of humble people who are just doing really good work, and they're not on the social media bandwagon, beating the brass every time they, you know, go to the bathroom or do whatever. But they're doing just excellent work. And so it's our privilege to kind of highlight some of that. And that's what we're going to do today. And in the realm of hazmat, which has always been for me, Michael, and you alluded to it a little bit, it's always been a bit of an elusive discipline to me. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. It didn't grab me the way other things did. I was more interested in other aspects of the job. And so that's where the guts of my attention went. But good Lord, man, I'll tell you, Michael, I'll tell you when I know I needed more work on it was when we got one. And, you know, and that tone rang out, and I was never afraid of emergency work. I cherished the time when actual true emergency work popped up and we could get away from, you know, a lot of the other crap that we just had to do, the stuff they paid you for, and we actually got to do real emergency work. But I'll tell you, when I saw a decent hazmat pop up across the ticker tape there and it printed up on the printer, and especially when it said something like hazmat major or something like that, it definitely does cause you to pause because you know you're going into something that you haven't done a lot. We do our best to practice it, but you only practice things so much. And that's why I think it's a really good thing to do, to actually talk to the people who have done it well, have studied it, get it, have figured out ways to make dummies like your humble radio host figure it out. And that's what we have today. And, very cool, Mike. We get to come over to the West Coast and talk to my brother, Battalion Chief Phil Ambrose. He has, for his bio, is a BC for a large metropolitan Class 1 fire department in SoCal. He's down in the area where I was born, Michael, down in sunny Southern California. For the past 27 years, Phil has been involved in fire and emergency services as a fire captain, firefighter paramedic, and a hazmat specialist. He is the founder, the president, the leader, the grand poobah of hazmatnation.com, and I'm very anxious to dig into a little bit of that, hear what that organization is doing. He's the inventor of the HazSim training device, which is used by U.S. and fire military members across the nation. He has a bachelor's. That's good to know that you're educated, Phil. He has a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Loyola Marymount, and will be teaching for his fourth summer at the upcoming FDIC, and I know we'll ask you probably about your FDIC class. Off-duty, he's not just a fire nerd. Off-duty, he's a swimmer, he's a surfer, doing all the SoCal stuff, participates in Ironman triathlons, and probably as important as anything for Mike and I. He thinks it's important in his bio to put, in spending time with his wife and his two sons, something that we can heartily endorse. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's our privilege to welcome to the Mikey G and Mikey B show Battalion Chief Phil Ambrose. Phil, welcome aboard, brother. How are you?
I am great. Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Mike. It's quite the honor. I wasn't sure who you were talking about when you're doing lots of the intros. I like to say that I usually bring down the average IQ in any room I walk into. So getting all that, I do have to preface by saying I am no smarter than the next one, and just try to work hard at the things that are important. I got to thank you guys not just for the opportunity, but for sticking with it over all these years, giving full-blown careers to both of your departments and then keeping with it. Because as you know, and as I do, being passionate about this and taking it to the level you guys are taking it, it's not for the money, right? But it's about helping others, and that's what I enjoy about this whole thing.
Yeah, well, very well said. And I think, in our intro for Mike and I, just even mentioning Janet, that's the spirit of what you just described, Phil. And even though you're a humble guy, and it's going to be hard for you. I know it's hard for all of us to talk about our stuff. I get it. But people do want to know who you are. They do want to know what you're about. My hope is by the end of all of this that your phone's going to be ringing and that people are going to be hiring you to come talk hazmat stuff. Because we really need it, and we need it from people who love the craft and actually try to make the craft digestible for those of us in the street. So just real quick, to get us fired up, to get your vocal cords warmed up, tell us about yourself, a little about your career, that type of thing. And if you wouldn't mind, we'll talk hazmat for the rest of this stuff. But just get us warmed up with what is it about what we do that gets you so fired up?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, thanks. And yeah, my phone's ringing off the hook. The one thing I can guarantee is I like connecting people to other smarter people, because one thing about this, and we'll get into it, I've met so many good people who they're not necessarily out there, they're not necessarily in the pages or on the websites, but they've got lots to share and good content, and they're awesome when they're willing and ready to help other people, give out their phone number and all that. So I've been in the fire service side for now 20 years. I started during college. I had the bug for emergency services, and I was chasing a dog looking for lost people, jumping out of helicopters, and gradually ended up in hazmat almost by accident. Nobody likes hazmat. It's lousy. No, it's one of those careers I fell into because I was able to get a job that I could roller skate to work. And then if you Google radioactive monkey urine, you'll see all about how I started, which was working at a university research lab, picking up chemicals, and one of them included radioactive monkey urine and anything else you can describe that involved hazardous materials. But so if, no pun intended, I got exposed to quite a bit of it. It's actually a fairly fun job. I was right out of college and didn't want to sit behind a desk and had not yet gotten the full firebug yet, but I was immersed in it. You had to know about it because you're dealing directly with chemicals that cause you harm. So almost by default, you had to learn about it. Plus you do all the training, and I got off work at 3 o'clock and I could skate home. So I enjoyed it for all of those things. And I got into the fire service a little later in life after, of course, having a neighbor that was a LA County firefighter, and every day I was going to work, he was hooking up his boat. So I thought I'd give that a try, and I've loved every minute of it since. Within the fire service, I'm lucky. I work for Glendale Fire Department down in Southern California, and we are, we like to say it, and we can prove it, that we're the best fire department in the world, because we pretty much got everything good people. I'm still the only Phil in our department, so if I do something good or if I screw up, they're going to know who it is. But we have really good personnel, and we have our own hazmat team, our own USAR team, and it stuck with me. I got out of the academy, and they put me right into the hazmat team, so my experience just kind of followed me. And I knew it was something I just needed to embrace and get into, and that's usually what I do with things. And I think we're going to go through a few more questions, but it developed as something that I saw as not only something I needed to learn for my own self, stay safe, it helped me also as a firefighter, and I can show proof of that, and then helping other people, because it was easy. It's easy in hazmat, or at least back even when I started, it's like, oh God, that's hazmat, you know, let's stay away from it and not even bother with it. And part of what I teach in at FDIC is that pretty much every fire is a hazmat scene, so get over it, get used to it, deal with it, and get good at it.
That's cool. That's cool. And we can talk about it, because the question I have is our second question, and it's very interesting because it comes on the heel of a very interesting fire in New York City that we had. But hazmat is never first in. What do you tell non-hazmat firefighters about hazmat being first in? And the reason I like this question is because in the city of New York, we had the other day, we had a fifth alarm in a warehouse that stored flammable chemicals. And they were bringing in stuff from resources from all over New York City with foam units and everything else, because again, for us, you know, truckies and engine brothers and sisters, you start putting water on this stuff and it floats on water, we're in a load of stuff here. We got to talk to the people who know this stuff. So tell us about this stuff, because I think it's so cool. It's just happened.
Yeah, Mike, that's a perfect example. And I think things really have started to shift because and it was nobody's fault necessarily, but, you know, hazmat units were specialized and they'd go off to school. And it was like, hey, stage for the hazmat team, hold for the hazmat team. And more we have good examples. I mean, here in L.A., we had the Boyd Street incident, which was, you know, basically an illegal grow facility with gas that had exploded. You had your example there. So many examples that come up where chemicals involved, where your traditional hazmat that goes back and, you know, from when lots of the regulations started, from, you know, rail car disasters and fixed chemical facilities, you know, we're learning now and we're experiencing that it's all around it. And just like out here out west, we've got wildland fires, and we might have a wildland fire that goes up into a, you know, heavy timber versus light flashy fuels. I mean, it's still a wildland fire, but there's different tactics and strategies in dealing with that fire. So why any firefighter, any professional firefighter, I say professional is not talking about whether or not you get a paycheck. I mean professional as do you take your job to that level of considering yourself a professional, which means you went all in and you're learning it, you're expecting the unexpected, which means, of course, you're going into a structure and you may have, whether it be gas cylinders or, you know, illicit materials or excess, you know, who knows? Since pandemic and stay at home, I mean, we've seen all sorts of unusual things at home. You know, restaurants now with more propane cylinders, all these things around us that are generally commonplace that we're used to, such as the propane cylinder example, that is almost so commonplace we don't pay a whole lot of attention to it until it rears its ugly head. And lots of the regulations that control dangerous goods, they're awesome when people follow the regulations, but your illicit labs, your somebody cutting corners, your whether it be the guy in the van pumping fuel, you know, stealing gasoline, all those examples that are hazards that it's not a matter of, you know, if it's when you will deal with, you better be ready. So what I tell the non-hazmat firefighters is fire's hazmat. Just face it, it's similar to a hazmat scene, or whether you want to you know, flex and say, no, a hazmat's like a fire scene, you still got to size it up. You still have to you know, continually size it up, reassess, get a good picture. Yeah, hazmat's a little different because you're not necessarily looking at it. I argue this all the time. When there's smoke and fire, it's generally obvious. It's giving you lots of signs. You're seeing it. But when it's a gas leak that you can't see and maybe can't even smell, and you're chasing that ghost around, it's a little more complicated, and we have historical examples that prove, you know, like an incident they had in Phoenix years ago with a gas leak in the street that not only blew up the shoe store behind the station, but caused a whole lot of damage. It's departments like that that had the immediate wake-up call to go, whoa, we have to take every one of these seriously. So what I tell the non-hazmat fires is expect the unexpected like we should. You know, consider that. Always consider that. If you're fighting a car fire, it could be a standard car fire, or it could have chemicals in it. It could be a van that's got a, you know, 55-gallon drum of more fuel than it should in there. That and use your tools. Not everybody across the country has the luxury of having a thermal imager, although that is becoming much more common. But if you use the thermal imager as an example, there are departments that don't even have them or just have them, and then there are departments that have had them for years, like my department. And then talk about being professional. Are you professional that you know how to use that tick and that you could gather some good intel on that next call, whatever it may be for? You know, it's the tick is not just for victim location anymore. How would you use it in a hazmat? Well, hey, there's a possibility, depending on what you have going on in your situation, that you can get a heat signature, a read. Getting good intel for when you call the hazmat team, and we'll go over some of these. Wearing your PPE, just like on a fire. You show up and like the poor kid that ended up on the internet wearing, you know, a T-shirt and shorts and the SCBA putting out a car fire that got shamed across the internet a few years ago. Show up you mean business. Hazmat, we go into all these letters. I think we stop at D, right, A, B, C, D, for levels of PPE. And the fact of the matter is, properly worn firefighter turnouts with your hood, with your gloves, with your SCBA, I don't even really care. I care, but I don't, what it comes down to is there might be all sorts of, manufacturers' recommendations on the equipment on what to wear, and I'm not advocating intentionally wearing the wrong gear, but full firefighter turnouts and SCBA can protect you from a whole lot of things, but they won't do anything if you don't wear them. So those are what I like to let the first-in companies know. It's no different than you're assigned rapid intervention. You better have your gear on, ready to go, paying attention to make that rescue. Same thing, you get a gas leak, you can't see it, it's not giving you any good indication, you don't have birds falling from the sky. Hey, play like it's the real thing, get good information, wear your gear. Those are the fine points I like to lay out to people.
Well, I think I alluded to in the first part of this, Phil, and I don't think I'm alone in this. I'm not the only dummy out there who, I think your heart skipped a little bit of a beat when the hazmat response came in. And part of that is, and you know, I'll share a couple of these later on, but a part of that is just a couple of experiences I had where just trying to do the best job I could. And, you know, mostly just doing the wrong thing, you know. Unintentionally doing the wrong thing. So let's just start with this, and then I'm sure Mike has a couple that he'll probably bring up. Just what are a few of the common mistakes? And again, we're talking about the average Joe responding on the average rig, and boom, a hazmat response starts. The hazmat team is not there. They're wherever they're stationed. They're a ways away. And here you are, and you know, the baton has passed to you, and you need to start this on the right way, set it up in the right way, establish a foundation for success, and not make common mistakes. We're always going to make a mistake, but what are some of the common ones you see that we're making all the time?
I think, Mike, right off the bat, just own it. It's your incident, right? If you showed up at a house fire, you're not going to give up your hose line or the opportunity to go vent. I mean, you're going to do your job. So even if it's ultimately a hazmat, size it up. The simple stuff we train, right? Uphill, upwind, which we should be thinking about all the time, even on a fire. Why would you stand in the smoke if you can step 10 feet, you know, in another direction and not stand in the smoke while you are, masking up? Get the intel. utilize the tools. I mean, there's a set of Bushnells on, I think, every fire engine across the country that usually are buried underneath the seat that are there for a reason, which is, you know, use those binoculars and get some intel. Proper notifications, get the hazmat team rolling early, wearing that PPE. The last thing I would have done as a hazmat captain or hazmat firefighter is show up and laugh at the first in for wearing their full turnouts and their SCBA. There's no issues with that. Paying attention, you know, set it up, size it up, use those tools, like I said. Uphill, upwind sounds so simple, but think about it. Think about, just like we think about where fire is going next, is, you know, hey, from where's the hazmat rig going to park to shelter in place versus evacuation, where am I sending those people? Nothing different than if there is a loom up over whatever incident you're at. And then with that intel, it's and we'll talk a little bit about it because we're going to get into my class. There, you do get into that gray area of, you know, we have communities across the country where the hazmat team could be 20, 30 minutes away, and that's a lot of time to be there. So sizing up just like you would on any other type of structure is, do I have a life safety issue here? Is there an immediate need to do some sort of intervention? And if not, then it's just a matter of doing all those things I mentioned, which is setting it up right, moving people out of the way, getting good intel. That makes sense?
Yeah. No, yeah, that makes totally does.
Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, the funny thing to me, Phil, is that it feels like I knew we were going to have you on. So I started going back over all of the incidents that I'd been on, and I, you know, most of them went just fine. You don't even remember those. The only ones you remember are the ones that, you know, probably didn't go right. And so they stick in your mind and you just continually go back over what you would have done differently. And I was trying in my mind to go back to just common mistakes. And I know for me, one of them was you have to discipline yourself to move at a slower pace than what you would at a typical house fire, because the hazard zone is different and you don't know the hazard zone. And I remember having to be told, just come in a bit slower and figure out where you're going to be, what the wind is doing. You know, try to gauge the wind big time before you get in, because the winds swirl, and what they say on the response sheet is not what you get, you know, when you get down by the water or you get down amongst big buildings. It ain't coming out of the northwest. It's coming out of the north, south, east, and west. And just trying to figure out, you know, the best place to be so that you're not initially part of the problem. Start from a position of strength, and you can always, once you're protected, move in. And I know that was one of them. I made that mistake pretty early on. I never made it again, but those are the types of things I was thinking about.
You're Seattle Station 10 there on the C shift. I think it's still on YouTube, and they did a great 8 or 10 minute long hazmat fro video, which is, there's some talented, you got some talented people over there. Very funny, very informative, but of course, you know, they show the battalion chief show up and his fire SUV driving right through the liquid that had spilled and make all those common mistakes. But I agree with you there. There's no hurry, but, and the big but is I'm not a huge fan of the term, the rule of thumb, right? You're far enough because your thumb can cover the incident, and that's all well and good. And especially if you're really responding to whether it be energetic materials or just some rather large industrial complex. And I think all of us as professionals should have a good idea of our district. That's without exception. You should have a good, solid idea of your district. So if you're going into something that's, you know, it's a overturned pool chemical truck, for example, and it's in a neighborhood where, you know, there's lots of pools, and it's got Joe's pool cleaning on the side of it, that's a hazmat. But with all of that intel and doing your right 360 and approaching it correctly, you should also be able to use the foresight to know that if you've got your proper PPE on and poor Joe's, you know, pinned underneath that vehicle taking, you know, his last few gasps of air, that, you know, you're well within your scope of practice, if you will, to initiate some sort of intervention. So I say move slow, move with purpose. So don't drag your feet intentionally to drag your feet, but use that time to get information and to gather that and be able to make that risk assessment. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I think that's incredible, and I think you're 100% right on that. And it kind of leads into our next question. What do you feel are some of the responses that seem simple but have a potential for big problems? And I know you mentioned one already, and I know New York City has had some major issues with it, with gas leaks are one of them.
Oh.
But, you know, we had one of our officers killed in an illegal hookup for an illegal grow. And but we have gas leaks. We've had the East Harlem one where we lost a minimum of 8 people. We don't know if we lost more because we took down 2 5-story buildings. And we don't know if anybody, you know, homeless tended to be in that area. We don't know if we lost some that we didn't account for. But so tell us about some of the responses that can seem simple but have a potential, because everybody's seen some of these that have gone bad.
Well, I think your example, Mike, not only is that, it's just a great example to use when you're really hammering, you know, hazmat and fire, which is before that thing lights off, it's potentially just a hazmat or a gas leak. I think you nailed it there. That's definitely, you know, and being a professional, that's something I never tolerate, which would be crews going to any sort of gas leak and downplaying it, because the risk is that high. We're different here out on the West Coast, at least in the big city of Los Angeles, because it's mostly all just plumbed in natural gas. Still a high potential, but versus areas of our country that have way more propane tanks. Then, like you mentioned, the nefarious stuff, which your incident your couple years ago, as well as I mentioned the Boyd Street incident in LA City, which was also related to explosive gas, basically, that they were doing. They were actually still doing everything right, and bad things can happen. You know, probably the kind of ventilation hole, you know, the top, you know, the hazmat is like that. What they're in it for, of course, is a good stinger operation from a rolled over tanker. Those are also incidents that, you know, they happen. If it's contained, then the hazmat team gets to come in and sting that thing and you know, drill on that gasoline tanker and suck it out. But if you're first in on an incident like that and it's leaking, you've got now in a liquid state flammable material that can be going all over the place. And we've had those incidents where you're talking, you know, especially Los Angeles, all of our towns, right? They're designed to take water from the sky and send it all directions. So you very infrequent, but you have the potential for those incidents to reach an ignition source, and then you've got fire everywhere. That's another one that just needs to be taken incredibly serious. On the lighter side, and hazmat, which is only just to go to the other end of the spectrum, and these are the ones where the life hazard is a whole lot less, and you can slow down, and it turns into definitely a hazmat team response. If you've got hospitals, research facilities, your retired college professor that's got mercury in his garage, those kind of simple incidents, that one's a life safety negative. It's going to be, you know, long-term effects, it's not going to be, I'm not saying it's not bad, but it's not going to acutely affect your system. But a simple, what looks like a simple mercury spill, I've seen those go sideways and cost, whether it be the city or the residents, a whole lot of money from people getting there going, oh, this is just a, you know, like a probably an industrial thermostat. It's not a whole lot. I'm going to start sweeping it up before the crew gets here. Well, you show up with a mercury vapor detector, it's all over the place. And once you pull that thing out, now it's like you've notified the authorities that you're looking for this stuff. The contamination spread could be, I remember early on in my hazmat career, we had to actually salvage and destroy a 1990 Toyota pickup truck because some mercury had spilled in it. And, you know, initial responders, if you will, had tried to kind of clean it up, and all they did is spread it throughout the vehicle. So only to go to the other end of the spectrum, which not only don't get any on you, don't make it worse, but I think your example of the gas leak, which is something when you've got a invisible, you know, matter looking for an ignition source or something that could potentially asphyxiate, you need to take the right approach, wear your gear, and be thinking. Those are my two extremes of kind of the hazmat. When you get into other another, you know, popular one, or people will get, it gets the hairs up on people with things, say, that involve radiation. I can't give you a whole lot of examples of just regular use, you know, radiation that's going to be an issue. Those are things that, if, of course, in the hands of the wrong people that want to do bad stuff, there's that potential on the nuclear side. But I'd be most worried about those, that genie that's out of the bottle. Like, if you remember back, I think we're all old enough to remember back when Boots and Coots was taking care of the oil well problems that in Kuwait. You know, one of the first things they do is throw a flare into it and set that thing on fire, which everybody's like, what the heck are they doing that for? But then they see their problem. It's a little easier to deal with knowing what's going on. And it's those gases that probably have the most potential to really wreak havoc on us.
Yeah. Great point. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, so that was a good answer. You know, funny, when we were talking about what the questions were going to be, we wanted that one more towards the top. And I'll tell you what I had in mind, Phil, and then you can elaborate on this as a strategy, I think, for, you know, as company officers. I'll tell you the one that bugged the hell out of me the most, and it's the one I saw a lot, was just that random single response, whether you're an engine or a truck, and you respond to that random barrel of stuff that has either fallen off a truck, has rolled away from a warehouse, is leaking crap into the gutter, whatever, and you get sent on that to evaluate. And I always laughed whenever we were responding to those. It's like, how do you want me to evaluate it? You know, it's like, yeah, there's a barrel of stuff that's leaking. I don't know what it is. You know, most of the barrels aren't marked. You have no clue what they are. Nobody is dying from it. But what do you want me to do with it? And so we end up on the phone with the hazmat team, just saying, hey, how do you want me to identify this or whatever? It was those more common ones, Phil, that I'll tell you probably bothered me more than some of the bigger ones, because the bigger ones, we were in full on, you know, let's pay attention to what we're doing and wind and everything else and setting up zones and everything. These other ones, you know, gas leaks or these different things, we kind of roll in and try to figure out what's what. And I will say this to your company officers. I'm glad I did this. After the second barrel of unknown crap laying in the middle of the street, blocking off traffic, which in the city in particular, blocked off streets in the city are not good things. And a lot of people surround that, and it can become a problem really fast. I got very good numbers listed on a little notepad of who to call in the city, and not just the general numbers, which you never get through to, but who to call in the city to mitigate those types of things. And it saved us a lot of time on the back end, where if you don't have that, you're just stuck out there. The hazmat team is on some response. They can't go to it. And you're stuck on that barrel for 3 hours looking like a dummy or doing unsafe stuff, right, Phil? Doing unsafe stuff, getting in the middle of it. So go ahead with that. That's what I was
thinking. Yeah, I love that you bring that up, because this isn't exactly the sexy side of hazmat, but as far as giving first-in tips and tricks, it's good advice, because your exact example. You know, you got the engineer that's late for his favorite program. You know, everybody else is like, well, Cap, what the heck? Why are we on this thing? You know, and then you're thinking, I'm going to call, you know, whoever, you know, they start thinking, well, I got to make notifications. I'm going to tell dispatch to call Fish and Game, Coast Guard, whoever it is. All those agencies are going to go, you got a what? And it's one drum? Yeah, you're on your own. So the key thing, takeaway you just gave is if you have good relationships with those who are responsible for picking those things up in your city or county and dealing with them, and, of course, getting them good information, it can't be easier than it is now because you can – you can FaceTime or, you know, shoot pictures, high-resolution Zoom, bring out your department drone, whatever you're going to do. You can get great intel to all these resources, and they'll be able to tell you pretty quick. At the same time, don't necessarily minimize it. Another tough one is single-engine response, odor, and it's a public storage facility. It's some sort of, public storage in a general term. It is a you know, multi-story building that contains individually operated storage from old, you know, palm trees to somebody's junk. And now your crew's walking around, and what do? They're going to walk around sniff with their own nose because they're just trying to follow up on the complaint. And then it's, do you have a gas leak? Do you have a – is it a dead body? Do I ask somebody to come here with keys and open up every one of these? Do I call the hazmat team? Can I even see anything? So now I'm chasing this ghost. And that's where I really think having a – starting out and having a good plan just without – having a good plan rather than kind of chasing this thing and saying, all right, no different than, you know, we lost Jimmy and I need to search this building. Let's come up with a plan of how we're going to take care of this and whether or not we do need the hazmat team. And I'm talking about this one because it's that warbler, right? You can potentially punt it to the hazmat team, but maybe they're not available or maybe this is so considering HVAC systems, considering all of those things. But I don't know how many I've been on in my career where it was likely, you know, the truck idling near the intake that caused, you know, some headaches inside the building. I forgot to throw in public storage is easy because you've got a bunch of junk staging that people are paying to store. But now you take an office building on a Friday before a holiday weekend with multiple patients complaining of headaches. Well, you don't want to lightweight it and say it's a nothing. You don't want to say, it must have been the delivery truck idling and now everything's cool. And that's get your plan together. So, sure, the hazmat team's coming, but you've got a bigger problem because now you've got people that were potentially symptomatic, right, which doesn't necessarily mean they were exposed. So all these things they can be generally boring. It's not – everybody likes to – you know, the truckies like to talk about cut holes, and we like to talk about flow path, but how would you approach something like that? I've seen the best ones end up well by just a good approach and a solid plan and doing that from the first-in perspective and not saying, hey, I'm going to let the hazmat team come in and tell us what to do, because in the time they're taking to get there – or the decision to call them, might be a little too late. You can get some better intel because the other guarantee you're going to have is, at least here in Los Angeles, you'll have a minimum of 6 or 8 helicopters overhead and news crews filming your every action. Then when you're under the gun, you're going to start making, you know, maybe not as good decisions or some, or some hasty decisions where just set it up early. What I mean by that is, you know, isolate. You get your crews back, consider the evacuations and your zones, and just set up a plan, given direction. I mean, having your engineer that's not going to be pumping a line, if you're lucky enough to have an engineer or chauffeur, start to map this thing out. All of those little things that go a long way when, the hazmat crew rolls up and you can tell them, I got this, I've done this, I've done this. Here's what we got. When we show up, it makes it a lot easier than starting from ground zero.
Yeah, oh, good. Yeah, that's – well, again, it's kind of funny. Knowing I was going to have you on, I started to go back through, you know, years and years and years of responding to multiple types of these incidences. And I don't want everybody to get the wrong impression that we screwed up everyone we went on, but the ones you think about are the ones that didn't go as well. The ones that went well, it's like, oh, I had another good day and rock on. So here we go. The question is, any tips for not becoming part of the problem? And I put, i.e., getting exposed, you know, being exposed to the product yourself. And it comes from, I'm a boot lieutenant responding in a district that I don't know and responding to the University of Washington. So it's this massive complex. And, you know, everybody says, know your district. You're responsible for knowing your district. Yeah, I was at this job for about a month, and it would have taken me 10 years to know the university district and everything that was going on. And we respond to a hazmat response, full hazmat response with people exposed. We did good. We pulled up. We were out of the, you know, did the wind right, did the whole thing, you know, But eventually you got to, you know, engage. And as we started to engage, as everything started to come in, we didn't go to the product, Phil. The product came to us in the form of people evacuating the building with, you know, the product on them. And I'll never forget being, because I did the right thing. We radioed that, you know, there was a chance that we had been exposed, so we got now taken out of it. We got kind of corralled in this pen with the rest of the people. I'll never, as long as I live, forget the angst, the frustration and anger of being shuffled off into that pit while everything else is going on, and we're part of the exposed. So sometimes there's nothing you can do, but if you would, for our listeners, kind of give them a few tips of how to keep from having the product get on you. And it's obvious you don't go wallowing in it. But talk about people coming out with the product on and wins. And, you know, Mike had a good thing, water. You know, if we start doing any type of water, the stuff traveling on water, just talk in generality about staying, not becoming part of that problem.
Yeah, and that your university example, anybody that has a university and their first in, I tell you, if it's your second or third in, walk it, get to know it, because I've worked at two major universities, and then we have within our response district here, we've got some pretty heavy facilities. It's interesting because for every two people that you have running out, you'll have a student with their head down and their backpack on heading in because they're just trying to go to class and they're oblivious to what's happening. And I actually was in the middle of a level A entry at a large university in Los Angeles. And as we're making entry, even though it was all closed off, we had students hustling past us. And maybe nowadays they'd be they'd probably try to take a selfie with us or something. But back then, I guarantee you they had no idea what the big giant yellow suits and the breathers, I remember vividly how it wasn't even a, it didn't even cross their mind. They were just late for class and they're headed that way. Backing up, yeah, the obvious, don't go rolling in it. But see, I will credit COVID for one thing. Actually, two things that I'm personally thankful to the old COVID. One is I firmly believe that our rates of occupational firefighter cancer will probably be dropping. I hope. It's always been my hope. But I think that firefighters in general became much better at donning and doffing PPE because they had to. All of our crews here were, especially early on in COVID, you know, dressing out. The poor anybody that does fire-based EMS or if they're out there doing EMS, they're putting on gowns and gloves and this and that. I think we got better at it, and I noticed at least out here, even on the West Coast, that wearing station boots in the station and all those, you know, contamination reduction things for cancer in the fire service, I believe, and I hope, have dropped. The other thing COVID did, though, is did get firefighters a little more familiar with other PPE besides just their turnouts. And I know most companies now, at least in the big cities, even if you're not hazmat, you're just operational trained, you are going to still be carrying plastic suits. I mean, there's been tens and hundreds of millions of dollars of federal money given to all the cities to put plastic suits on rigs, you know, that could be used where appropriate. So make sure you pull that thing out and realize that the creases aren't all bent out of shape before you try to put it on. predicting where the path of the people is no different than a fire. People are going to exit a structure, likelihood, the same way they come in and out of it every day. That's just what they're going to do. That's what they're familiar with. I mentioned the Bushnells, the binoculars, when it comes to identifying products from a distance, but all those things that we see in training videos that we go, oh, we're never going to use the bullhorn until you need to, until you need to use that bullhorn and direct people. I'm a big fan of not just in fire, but even on a simple EMS call, is everybody having a role. So, of course, we're always going to talk about who's leading the search, this and that, however you're running your crew, who's got nozzle. But, you know, how often does a crew just talk, hey, if we get something today, and who knows, maybe it's an active shooter that also sprayed acid at a group of people. And now we have a group of people come rushing out. Who's going to do what? Who's potentially going to stop and maybe start setting up a hose line for decon versus who might be corralling people? But not having any sort of plan for that, you are I can't find a better word than screwed, because then in your university example, you've got zombies pouring out of that building that are potentially they may or may not be exposed, but they think they are. And now they're bringing it to you. And because you didn't have a good plan, at least to say, let's send them over here and corral them this way. Now you're part of the problem. I think on the other end of the spectrum, we talked about the obvious of not stepping in it. My crude analogy is, you know, on any type of EMS run, if you find out there's poop on the floor, everybody will jump up like a cat and nobody's going to step in it. When it comes to chemicals and all the rest of the things, I think we're a little slower to react because we have this sense of, you know, these $300 boots are going to protect me. I think if we keep the same mindset when it comes to whatever may be dripping or leaking and be smart about it, and move out of the way. You mentioned decon, but I also going to throw in there just general containment. It's completely okay if a first responder that's not hazmat, there's nothing saying that if there's a liquid leaking, they can't throw dirt on the ground and redirect it another path away from where people may be, within reason. There's nothing saying that you can't at least identify an area of safe refuge for the people that's uphill, upwind, things just to think about. And then just don't get complacent, because if you didn't have a plan and then maybe you're waiting for the hazmat team and it's that mid-range, doesn't seem like a crazy call, but it is. And then you have that one crew member that kind of breaks ranks and discipline and says, I'm just going to go over there. I'm pretty sure this is the same stuff I used to, grout the tile and in my remodel. And I'm just going to go, swipe a finger of this stuff and smell it, taste it, all that stuff. Just have some discipline there. And as long as you always stick with the plan, like anything else we do, which is trigger points. Sure. If you find a building manager that shows up and says, oh my gosh, yeah, we just changed the oil in the hydraulic system of the elevator. That was the drum we used and it's leaky. They can vouch for it. Awesome. Until then, treat it like it should be. Treat it like an unknown and do your job. Get people away from it. Think about all sides of that incident, meaning where's this going to go and where's it going to be in 30 minutes. Hopefully that kind of helped answer the question. I think it remains obvious, but more than just don't get any on you, don't bring it back. This incident will close, and then the same substance that we had a city block closed for that maybe was determined mildly hazardous still shouldn't end up on the bottom of your turnout boots getting into your rig. So whether you choose to do a full-blown hose line gross decontamination like most of us should have all been trained on or something we always consider is just don't spread that incident beyond the confines of that incident. And I use the mercury example, which is not too sexy. It's not on fire. It's not blowing up. But back in especially the 90s, when every health clinic, every hospital had the mercury blood pressure cuff on the wall and those things were popping. That stuff can just go everywhere. I saw an entire wing of a hospital shut for half a day due to a cleanup because somebody thought it'd be a good idea to start trying to clean it up with a broom, and all they did is spread it. So be smart, set up your, do your initial, you know, scene size up, isolate, make your notifications and set that thing up smart. If you make your perimeter too big, you can always bring it down, but it's a lot tougher to start expanding a perimeter and controlling people, later. Utilize your other resources. Identify that good safe zone, even if it's further away, make it further away. Then you could utilize your cops, let them do their thing. If you start to get more information that this is smaller and not bigger, it's a lot easier to reduce that zone than try to start telling the same people you told to stand under that tree, hey, now you got to move another block away because we screwed this up.
That sounds great, man. And, you know, again, it's always best, in my opinion, make it bigger. You can always make it smaller once you know. But playing catch-up, as you said, is just such a tough thing. And you and I share a passion for hands-on training. And you did something that I think is very interesting. Tell us about your passion for hands-on training and what you did to invent to ensure better training, what you did to make it better, the hands-on training.
I'm Mike. Yeah, I've surfed since I was a little kid, but I constantly am trying to get better because I'm older, fatter, less limber, and it's something. The only way I can do all the attempts at yoga and this and that, the only way I can get better at surfing is to surf. If you're ventilating a roof, a structure at 3 a.m, with the chainsaw, the only way you're going to, you know, effectively create your ventilation hole and you know, lickety split is practice with that tool, you know, muscle memory. So it's always something that just I've been a fan of, and it's how I learn. I've got to touch things. I've got to do things. I think where it came for me within hazmat, I actually mid-range in my early hazmat years, I was sent to all these classes. You get to travel and try, fried food and beer from places across the country to go to specialized training, and which I thought was awesome. Partly from the networking and meeting people, and you get an opportunity to train at these facilities that just have cool props. But for me, it was, that shouldn't be the checkbox that you do that, you know, once every 5 years of your career and you move on. This is it's perishable. It's your lettuce. You gotta keep going after it. So anything with hazmat I'd ever done is, A, just sticking to the basics, because what it comes down to, we've got to be able to swiftly put on our gear, because the amount of time it takes us to make an entry should not be delayed because we can't, you know, we can't fit in the right boots because we didn't have them, you know, all set up properly. To, if we're out there to put on the gear and stop a leak, we better know how to use that tool. And for me, then, you know, we're, my kind of passion turned is I noticed a complete breakdown when it came to using the monitors we had in hazmat, which now the monitors, at least across our big cities, they're on, you know, within LA County, they're on every apparatus, has a four gas monitor, which is a luxury considering some places still do not, but some of your larger metropolitan cities now, it's not uncommon to have a four gas detector, or even, you can even still have the old CDV radiation detector. But what I found is nobody really knew how to use them. They could turn them on. It was easy to say, it's confusing. There was that one person at your station that might be real passionate and know about it. But if he happened to be off shift that day, forget about it. Nobody really knew how to properly use it. And for me, the product I've invented, and now I've got three patents on, and it just kind of became, you know, in a sense, part of my life was to be able to simulate the meter readings for the end user to put what we call, I think the scientists call it the dread factor. We call it the pucker factor, where you can just not only recreate and see what the readings are, but you put somebody in a position where, hey, now you're going to go search for that that gas leak, but now I'm giving you actually realistic readings. So instead of walking around kind of faking it because, you know, hey, well, Ambrose isn't going to, he's not going to irradiate me. I'm safe here, so I'm just going to walk around and I'm going to be good and class will be over. I wanted to challenge the students because I think challenge, it's all good. It's how we operate. It's how you remember things. So with the, I ain't even calling it that product because it all just came out of necessity. I wanted to be able to send someone downrange, whether it be, you know, a first time, never used a detection device student, or, you know, maybe it's a 35-year lieutenant that just needs some refresher and on learning how to clear a building and use a monitor. And that's kind of where it all started. And then what was the greatest thing for me was we now have customers across, I can say, kind of the world. We breached into countries outside of the U.S., but what's been a great ride is I got front seat on the rig to go around and visit so many departments. So one of the things I learned is, you know, if you've seen one hazmat team, you've seen one hazmat team. If you've seen one, you know, just like fire stations too, there's so many similarities at all of our fire stations. And then there's just so many differences that usually rely on how much ownership that particular crew is taking in their craft and what kind of pride, you know, they're getting into knowing they're first in. So for me, it's been a bonus in my career, and I think it really accelerated my knowledge is being able to get out and not only be part of, you know, kind of honored to run, you know, from firefighters across the country to branches of the military, run them through training scenarios. But anybody that's taught, which everybody in this room has, is you learn so much from the students. A, because you better keep sharp, because if you're going to be dropping some knowledge, you better know what you're talking about and, you know, have experiences from the seat. But you learn so much from the people you're training with. So it ended up being quite a challenge, you know, developing a product and taking it to market. Is anybody wants to call me about that stuff, I'm happy to tell you. I usually say, take your idea, write it down, crumple it up, and throw it in a trash can because it's going to change your life. But for me, the bonus was I believe that necessity that then was part of the invention really just fed my passion for not just the fire service, but yes, the hazmat component of the fire service, which I think in general, learning from others, getting to train with others, listening to their wants, needs, hurts, and be able to identify and then kind of solve problems, you know, get people, because it's a real thing. It's not like you're, you know, telling them to change the channel on their TV to just watch something different. These are life-saving experiences that I feel can potentially help one of my peers not only make it to the end of that shift, but the end of a 30-year career and continue to live well and prosper in retirement. So it's kind of what's always driven me. Hope that wasn't too much on it, but that's kind of in a nutshell, Mike.
Excellent. Yeah, that's cool. And I think it's a great idea to get your hands on those meters, because those of us who are not using them every day, we tend to forget. I mean, I have a joke, because I am older, that everything I own that's electronic, I don't, one of them, there's not one that I know how to use 100%, including my alarm clock.
I can relate. I think it's interesting too, because I saw so many instances where, talk about first in hazmat, at least out here, anybody that's got any potential for radioactive materials within my career in hazmat, which started back in 94 officially. I saw lots of hazmat calls involving radiation go sideways solely because the individual could not read the meter. And just because a radiation detector just most other detectors, it's like, hey, you got your 20.9% of oxygen. Everything else is zero. Zero means good. Kind of like that's easy for a firefighter to understand. But when you get radiation readings, and it's like, hey, there's a reading because of background radiation, of course. But, well, what's normal? What's it normally at? And that was one of the kind of the solutions I wanted to solve is I still will not speak of the two specific incidents because they're high profile enough, but an entire incident revolved around the individual reading the meter incorrectly, kind of like reading your clock upside down, but hands-on, using it, getting in the zone, and honestly make things like a hazmat drill a little funner than just putting on a plastic suit and walking around and sweating off 10 pounds.
I think that's great.
You know, so that was a nice end discussion there. Mike Phil, I'm going to jump over question. The question I have is number 7, and I want to move right into number 8 because it's in this vein. And then we'll pick up 7 at the end. What do you know about the new NIOSH recommendations on odor fade and using gas detection devices? Let's just stay with a theme and plumb the depths of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that recently came out. And, you know, of course, same group that, you know, keeps track of line-of-duty deaths, not only statistics but investigations. And now they're putting out, you know, a pretty heavy piece directly related to gas detection, which that applies to everybody that wears the fire patch, right? Now we're not talking, hey, that's just send that memo over to the hazmat team. No, this is for everyone. And what they pointed out was a couple of different things, which is, and it really should, it is firefighter 101, right? That most of your flammable gases are odorized with the sole intent of being able to be noticed by humans, right? Because, you know, the gas company isn't pumping, you know, thousands of pounds of gas into homes and making money doing it. They're not going to have a very good business if they're blowing up houses every day. So, you know, they odorize those things with things like mercaptans, and every firefighter should know that and understand that. But it also has limitations. Those odorizers, they can wear out. They've got a shelf life, if you will. They can cause your nose to kind of shut off. COVID, you know, brought the attention to, you know, I've given my kids several COVID tests based on the smell test, similar to what you get in the day room at a fire station. But knowing that there's a thing called olfactory fatigue, which is that classic, hey, I don't smell it anymore. Well, there's actually, you know, gases that there's the point where you might have stopped smelling it was also because your nose just said, nah, I'm done with that. And you may still end up reaching that ideal H. And now, is it obvious? Is it like choking and gagging on smoke? No, it may not be obvious. So this NIOSH report, you know, came up talking about the odorizers and what can happen, because even in the piping systems that these odorant, you know, that the gases travel in, that even those, you know, concrete and different material pipes can actually absorb the odorizer and then remove it. Not in this report, but similar to, this is one thing I learned regionally too. And Mike on out there in the East Coast, it's similar for us. We always say the circus is in town because, you know, somebody gets termites and they tent the house. So it looks like the circus is there, a big bounce house. I realized that regionally, based on temperature, humidity, and all that stuff, I think you have a little bit of a different exterminator industry out there. But here on the West Coast, where you'll see these things go up for the termites, it's a chloropectin that they use to not only cause an odor but an irritant. Like it's basically like pepper spray that they're putting in that environment under the tent to treat the building for the termites to keep people out, because otherwise the Vicane gas really wouldn't have an odor. So that's not specifically addressed in the NIOSH, but the NIOSH is addressing A, the odor, and then B, the detection, so gas detection. So I talked a little bit about thermal imagers, which I think nowadays, especially your modern firefighters getting hired, you know, a lot of the big cities now, it's and you know, all the big breathing apparatus companies are all now integrating them in. We had some donated by our fire foundation, which was incredible. So now every firefighter and every rig has their own personal tick. And now we also provide, like I'd mentioned, gas detection devices. But then it's, are you using it? So the NIOSH report does go into that. Or are you using it? Are you making it as part of your arsenal to gather information? Now, knowing that, there's things it can't detect. And there's things it's okay at detecting, but things like gas leaks that could explode, it's actually pretty good at detecting. But it's not going to be very good if you haven't taken it out and exercised that thing and used it and learned how to do the fresh air calibrations and all that's required. So just like I discussed on anything else where you have an operation with your crew, whether, you know, whoever's making the hydrant and whoever's masking up and taking nozzle, for example, it's, hey, you're going to I used to say you're going to that gas leak call, but you may not know that it's that gas leak call. And I got to give this example just as to paint a picture. I use it in my class, if it's okay, Mike and Mike. Amarillo, Texas, and had the pleasure or the honor, really, to talk to the first in lieutenant. They had, if you paint the picture, they're on move up. Amarillo had a couple fires that night. It's a busy city. So this is a truck company. I believe it was a tower ladder. Just to picture it. So you've got a crew, it's middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning. They're heading on a move-up, so you can imagine the frame of mind. It wasn't that they were going on the next alarm. They were just moving districts. And en route, they get a what sounds to be like a carbon monoxide call at a manufactured home. So, you know, they redirect over there. And if I skip some of the details, I'll at least get the full intent to know that they weren't necessarily responding on a fire, necessarily a medical at first. It was just a CO. And at least at the time for that department, I believe it was also private ambulance companies that handled the EMS. So they're going there as support. Well, they got on scene, which ultimately ended up being, I want to say, 4 or 6 fatalities. And it was the pellets they use for killing rats in silos. That it only takes a couple of these pellets. It's and now, of course, I'm going to say it wrong. I've got actually a bottle of the stuff in my garage I use in travel, but ALP pellets, aluminum phosphide. And the one of the family members, they had a rat problem there. So one of the family members had picked some of this stuff up, I believe, from south of the border. Doesn't matter. Got a hold of it. So they said, I'm going to get rid of these rats, because anybody that's had a rat infestation, you're going to handle that, which he did. But at some point, somebody in the family had said, man, you got to get rid of that poison. We're not feeling so good. So he'd gotten a hose line and was spraying these things to just kind of wash them away. You know, dilution is the solution to pollution. So earlier that day, prior to EMS being called, a few of the family members had felt sick with flu-like symptoms. And now here this crew is walking into what ended up being a multi-fatality. We're talking children, just because the ALP pellets had off-gassed with that water and set off this phosphine gas. Why I bring this up as a discussion on this, they did actually bring their meter into that call because they were thinking CO. And they did, of course, then they were very distracted because now they have a borderline MCI, right, because it's more patients than what one four-person crew can handle. They're actually thinking, as it's going down, they're thinking, oh, this has got to be – this is probably a CO call. Let's get them to fresh air. Let's move on. I did have some crew members admit to me, man, I wish we had a plan. I wish we potentially had somebody throw on a breather, because they're right in the middle of it. This wasn't There was no chance to stage one block out, call hazmat. They were in the middle of it. And the moral of the story really was the takeaway I got from the class is you never know what you're going to get. And in this case, it was a hazmat. It also was fortunate that they and all the crew is okay. It was fortunate that it ended up that way because it had come in as a hazmat. There's that potential that we would have staged one block out. And in this case, with their proper PPE and even their breathers, they were able to effect a rescue. But they did get some readings because with any of the handheld detectors, and they had one person on their crew, I believe, that was hazmat that was over there. And if I missed some of the facts, those guys can call me and correct me. But you never know what you're going to get. You're easily going to be distracted, of course, with our primary operation, which is life safety and dealing with, in this case, children that were involved. But it's a good example of they actually went in with the meter because they were thinking CO call. So I guess challenge people for more often than not, if you're not looking at fire in the sky, fire and smoke in the sky, if you have the luxury of having that meter, use it. Bring it. Get used to it. Just make it part of your routine because if it could potentially give you information for that gas leak that can let you know you are truly in an explosive environment or potentially oxygen deficient environment because, you know, it's a nitrogen leak from some sort of refrigeration unit, and getting the information from that meter is going to be incredibly valuable. So, yeah, that's it's the NIOSH recommendation. I believe it should be a company school for anybody. If you're working for a department that doesn't have a gas detector, you think about it and you go, well, hey, our primary op is to walk around and sniff for the mercaptan smell. Then you're thinking to yourself, well, that might not actually be that smart. So get yourself a meter and use it. Be aware of the hazards of all these chemicals, and that NIOSH report lays it out pretty good. It keeps it very firefighter-friendly, if you will, and it keeps it simple. But I'm glad they came out with that because it's a pretty serious thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it's great information, and you really, for the young men and women out there listening to these calls, you got to pay attention to this stuff because, very honestly, this stuff is with you for the rest of your life, whatever you're exposed to. A lot of the things we're finding out now are they're cumulative, some of them, so you have to really pay attention to this. And with that, one of the things that I'm going to ask you is about Hazmat Nation. And could you tell us about it? And I think there's a misconception that it's only for the hazmat nerds, so to speak. Okay. But please fill our listeners in on Hazmat Nation.
I will, and it's There may be some nerding out. It's tough when you have to use the electronic equipment, the chemistry. But I got to tell you, at least in our department, I want to say every one of our, and it wasn't a requirement, but every one of our arson investigators is also hazmat. And they're really good arson investigators, I think, because of that hazmat component. I've, of course, always been in hazmat, but and I'm biased, but a lot of the hazmat personnel are really smart on fire calls. They get it, but maybe I've just been working with the best of the best. But Hazmat Nation just started as a conduit to provide information, and one of the things we wanted to solve, and there's a few of us involved in the team. It's been a group effort for years to you know, there's news content, but to learn something from it. So the NIOSH report, for example, part of the reason that came out was there was a line of duty death. There was Captain Mike Bell from Farmington, Maine, on a horrific propane explosion that killed him, which is obviously why then NIOSH created this report. So it was a gas leak call, and if anything, especially when somebody perishes, we need to learn from it. So part of the whole concept with Hazmat Nation was to get information to help everybody else. Because one of the things I found from traveling the country, which you know, was really by necessity to go around and train with my product, and I was fortunate to be able to do. I don't do it as much. I'm kind of glad the whole virtual world, and I now have a good team of people that assist doing that. But going around to all these other teams, I realized that not only does everybody do it a little differently, now they follow the regulations, so they follow that. They've got the same script, if you will. You know, the lane lines are there in the pool, but everybody's pool's a little shaped differently. But a common theme that came up was, wow, but those guys in you know, those guys in the big city, you name your big city X, oh, those paid personnel. And I started this by saying, when I say professional, doesn't necessarily have to mean you get a paycheck every 2 weeks. It means how much you're putting into it. So there's volunteer teams across the country that I've now had the opportunity to meet, learn stuff from, with even out there by you, Mike, from you know, teams in Pennsylvania like Bucks County. There's the awesome crews out of New Jersey and upstate there, all around. All that you're a little more used to. Southern California doesn't have much of, say, volunteer departments, but volunteer departments that also run a hazmat team or volunteers involved on it. And so it was to provide information for everybody to just learn from. So what we've been able to do with Hazmat Nation is contributors. Not everybody can write for fire engineering, right? There's only, and that doesn't mean because Bobby's not going to let you, because he will, but there's only so many pages, or maybe what you have to say is very unique and specific. So we've been a place that, you know, from Casey Jones in Little Rock, Arkansas, to Josh Fowler in Beaumont, Texas, have written articles, whether it be hazmat or leadership, individuals that have learned good experience that want to memorialize it, and then we put it up there. We add news stories, too. We try to at least always draw in news stories that have a connection. The stories I talked about, I've got several in my own Rolodex, but don't ever let a good call, you know, somebody else's call go, you know, go without at least trying to gain some experience about it. So lots of good content there. And then, of course, there is some merch. My 15-and-a-half-year-old son, he runs the merch account, and it's kind of fun when I see him getting on his bike to go down to the mailbox, and we're looking at the labels, and, you know, we have merch going to from Germany and Australia to all over the U.S., kind of repping the nation, which was all just meant to be a place for anybody that wants to learn. And it's not for just the hazmat nerds, or, and we got A students, we got D students. It's, you know, there's truckies in there. There's people that are proud of learning their craft or trying to get information. And that's really where it all started. Of course, it's been, you know, it's grown in several different ways. And we're not necessarily the experts, and we're not trying to be, but we definitely, probably coming from me, is if there's somebody that's got some good content, something they want to share, something they learned, a training prop they built themselves, I'm very, very much want to give those people a platform, and then for other people. So every now and then, it's funny, I don't even hardly think about it, and kind of like, oh, it's there, we're putting up content, and then you get a nice note from somebody. Or I think we had a day last year where the website went down and phones blown up and people telling me it's, and I was going, God, I didn't even realize it. Now we've got people from the community out there. So we dig it, and really just trying to make hazmat cool again, or at least put it out there. I have my other big passion is, you know, firefighter wellness, and just anything I can do to prevent firefighter cancer. I think it's a horrible way to go, and I think recognizing hazmat in general, I think it makes you better at practices that help you, not just for your job, but for kind of keeping your boots clean and doing things like that. So we do stuff with the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, and COVID kind of screwed things up a little bit, but at the International Association of Fire Chiefs Hazmat Conference out there in Baltimore, we had, I guess it was 3 years running. Usually the bar tab was probably double a standard Broslow tape, but it was fun just getting Hazmatters together, and that's really been a fun part from in a sense across the world sharing the stories, because you know, I see, well, I limit my time online, but you see so much about the whether it be the argument of what helmet is cooler, or you know, the taste great, less filling argument for those of us that remember those ads. But when it comes to the hazmat stuff, we really were all attacking the same problem, at whether it be an industrial firefighter or somebody that's truly on a C-Burnie squad that's really just waiting for that terrorist attack. There's so many similarities, and there's so many things we can learn, because there's nothing like finding that takeaway that makes your job easier. And it wasn't necessarily something you were going to find in a catalog, but you find out, you know, from Hazmat Nation, and whether it be an article or somebody you met through the network. And we're big fans of all of them too. There's some other good, say, groups of people out there, and we've always tried to be the ones that are just ready to give people a place to put up content and share it. And then we're lucky years ago where Bobby recognized that. We were part of his blog network. And, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. I mean.
Well, that was a good nutshell, dude. Man.
The big nut. That's like coconut.
Yeah, well done. So here's the thing that I'm pretty sure will be true. As folks now have listened to you articulate things pretty clearly and in a, I feel like, a very folksy, humble way, they're probably going to want to hear you in more detail and more focus than what we can do on the radio show. So whether that's through hiring you to come to their place, or I have at least one solution for those of you out there, Phil will be teaching at FDIC International, whose new dates are August 2 through 7, in Indianapolis. That would be a great place to come hear Phil talk. So two things on this next to the last question, Phil. One serious, one humorous. Tell us about your FDIC course, what you're going to be talking about. And then I just would be interested, for my own kind of perverse humor, what's the best nickname you've heard for hazmat teams? There's all these nicknames that go around. So I'll tell you the best one I heard. I never used it because I actually have really good friends on the hazmat team and have always, I don't know, I just always just had good relations and never really felt the need to rip them. But I know that one of my buddies who does not, he called them the glowworms. So I'd like to hear what yours are. But first things first, tell us about your FDIC class.
Well, a lot of what I discussed, so we went from full-blown hazmat to that drum in the street where you're scratching your head and wondering whether or not it's just a, you know, go get the plug buggy and pick this thing up and send it back to the city yard. One of the things I focused on, I'm not a fan of anything that's gray area, but it exists, right? It's there. And so I embrace it. I go, let's go all in on the confusing part and fix it and make it less confusing. So one of the areas in hazmat I realized early on that gets rough is rescue. When do you do it? And when I brought this up years ago, I had people tell me, oh, yeah, if the person's moving, it's okay to go in. It's like, oh, okay, I'll take a note of that. Or, if you see little feet, if a kid, then it's okay to go in. Oh, okay, got it. So I try to take a little bit. And then you got the regulation. Hey, whoa, what are you talking about? You know, breaking ranks here or breaking regulation, you're going to have all the regulators all over you. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. I mean, you got guys, you know, having internet arguments on whether or not to spray water in the window or from the inside or from the outside, and that's a big deal to them. Yet, you know, they can't run 6 minutes on a treadmill. So I'm always looking at how can we just do better? How can we just do better? So, and in the class, some of them are personal experiences, and I'll flat out, I'm not trying to tell somebody else's story, but through Hazmat Nation, and then another series we have, and we're actually going to drop one. We drop one every Friday is called Hazmatters, which is where we profile teams from across the country. What's great about it is the team sends it to us. We send them some merch, but we are delighted to tell everyone about your team, because it really doesn't matter what big city name is on your patch. It all comes down to what you got inside of you and how good you want to be at what you do. And that's true not just with Hazmat, but even in wildland firefighting. Some of the best wildland firefighting teams out there are not even paid. So the class goes over those instances where you're put in that position, and God forbid you might not be in a 30-year career where you have a potential hazmat and you have all at the same time you've got a rescue situation, you need to make the decision. So I go through what I would consider some fairly basic way to look at it. It's patented and copyrighted and locked up in a box, so I'm not allowed to use the phrase go, no go. But we go over some options, and one of the things, you know, in the basics, it's, you know, if you don't have bullets, bombs, or it's beyond your comfort zone, because once it gets beyond your comfort zone, you know, if you can't climb up two flights of stairs, don't take that division, right? If you're really uncomfortable, stay there. But if you use some of the you know, say tips and tricks, which really aren't tricks, some common sense approach that I advocate for using real life examples. What I don't want any of my peers to be in, nobody wants to make that mistake that causes injury to themselves or others, right? The last thing you want as a captain or any levels, have somebody on your crew get hurt because you guys did something. So risk versus gain. But on the other side of the coin, I profile case studies on things such as chemical suicides that, hey, sometimes these people don't do so. They're not very good at it, right? They're just trying to kill themselves, right? It's the first time, probably. So what happens when that person does not mix the chemicals correctly? So they're not dead, and they're savable. And do you actually spend the time to step back and wait 30 minutes for your hazmat team to, you know, pull the body out for the coroner? Or do you do your job, which is, you know, put on your necessary proper gear, you do a bit of an assessment, you change that risk profile, and you potentially go either ventilate or rescue that person. So I tried to take this. I was lucky through Hazmat Nation. I had a conduit where people would contact me and say, hey, Phil, I got one for you. This happened to us. You know, you can't name any names per se because we're embarrassed about it, but yeah, we had this call, and this is how we would have done it differently. So try to take all that, put it into one FDIC class. This will be my fourth year. I figure one of the things I learned early on taking classes, I was an instructor that said, I'm here to talk, you're here to listen. If you finish before me, let me know. So as long as people are willing to show up and listen, I'm happy to talk about it. It's all levels, as with any, and those gentlemen in the room who are some of my, you know, you guys are my mentors. I'm sure you've been there where you've got all levels in the classroom. So I try to teach to that, because hazmat should not be just something for the hazmat expert. We would not do that with any other discipline in fire, especially when it comes to setting up first in and taking care of, you know, our responsibilities, which in this case would be a potential rescue. So I'm looking forward to it. It's kind of a bummer I got moved last year, but kind of saw that coming, and it was almost a relief to, because things got busy out here, as we all did, that are still, you know, punching the clock and showing up at work. So I'm looking forward to it. The date change is unique. I don't think I've been to Indianapolis any other time but April, so we'll see how August rolls. I'm looking forward to being there. If anything, it's throw some tomatoes at me, do some networking, and I'm always looking for that next person that will take my place that's just as passionate about it and wants to keep talking, because nothing like increasing your personal skill level, your professionalism, by teaching at FDIC. It's an absolute honor. First time I was selected, I couldn't believe it. And the fact that I've been in the running now a few times and, you know, read my every single review I've gotten and take them all to heart, and happy to come back each year. So then those that don't know FDIC, which shame on you for not, it's nothing like getting that many firefighters together that are, you know, want to improve, want to learn. So it's an exciting place to be. And yeah, that's. I don't know if I sold it or not, because usually there's a much better class going on at the time I'm there. So we'll see. But I offer free beers afterwards, so maybe that'll get them in the door.
So that's your trick. I've heard you clear sold out.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
your trick, huh?
Jeez. But they always give you that giant room too. Like, I'm not going to fill these seats like other people, but it's good. Anybody that's considering it, I've been trying to encourage people all over that I meet. It's the first year I had applied, I did not get in, and got in that second year, and very proud to go there and take it very seriously. In fact, I'm kind of glad things got punted, because like any other typical firefighter, I've procrastinated, and I like to at least have fresh and new content in the materials, which I will have. So I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent.
Oh, and then your question. I've heard glowworms, nerds, hazmatters. Where our hazmat station is here in Glendale, the station's nickname, Camelot, so that was something that just stuck more, and it was just related to the station even prior to hazmat being there. I've heard several different ones. There's some good ones, and I what I like best is those that have that do cool patches. I mean, Dallas Hazmat, Union County, New Jersey has a great patch. There's trying to think of the department in Maine that's got it's a dinosaur. You know, the one with the long neck, like Fred Flintstone slides down, is their mascot and logo. So I'm a big fan of cool hazmat patch logos or anything that gives some ownership to your team. That's probably what I appreciate most out of any of the nicknames that turn into something that they can have some station pride over.
Cool.
Well, I'm sure maybe my mom's still listening, but if you've got any listeners left.
Well, you know what? Let's close out with that, brother. Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Okay, but most of them, believe it or not, listen and archive when they're working out. It drives them to do more.
Oh, good. Yeah. Poke their ears out. Yeah, it's not like hazmat to get you going, but I appreciate this opportunity. It is fun to chat about it. I'm looking forward to FDIC and especially seeing both of you guys.
Well,
brother,
appreciate
you did
it, brother. Thank
you. You did a great job. Yeah, you did a really good job. And as Michael kind of brings this to a close, what occurs to me and which you have highlighted, I think, in a wonderful way, this is serious stuff. You're going to go on them, and it's going to be an incident that you're not going to have a lot of sets and reps on, and so you've got to replicate that in another way. And, you know, and it's no different, I suppose, than fires, but for whatever reason, fires resonated with me more than hazmat incidents did. I mean, they just do. Auto extrications, those types of things. And I'll tell you when I wished I would have done more sets and reps, every single time when I wished, is when the printer started printing out hazmat response. And I immediately thought, I wish I would have prepared more for this. And so, you know, if we just keep reminding ourselves over and over again to do this.
And
stuff,
I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with you on that one, Mike. But, you know, our team, I think in the last couple of years, the guys have done I'm not going to exaggerate, but they've done a decent number of stinger operations. And talk about, as far as hazmat, getting in there and doing it, being able to drill into, 6,500 gallons of gasoline is on the freeway with all the news helicopters. There can be some glamour in hazmat. But then you could be standing there at the command post with all of your information and the IC saying, "Hey guys, we don't want to half-ass this, and Yep, yes, sir. We'll give you our full ass. So we brought out everything. We had our full ass meter, and we had everything that went into it. And there's, yeah, hey, it beats running a GI bleed, and it may not be as sexy as you know, structure fires, but let's face it, it can be pretty cool if you've got you know, a good working hazmat incident. It's And especially when everybody's turning to you going, God, I'm glad you guys are here. You guys know more about this stuff than we do. But my whole goal is to get everybody moved up a little bit so that they're more comfortable with these things. So, again, thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, you know, let me finish just with one thought. Because as I'm listening to this and I'm processing it, I'll tell you one of the reasons why I think at times we don't put the attention to it that we do is that we just always think, well, we're not going to have it for very long anyway because the experts are going to show up. We're just going to kick it off. And, boy, that is not true. I mean, that can be true sometimes. But, boy, the delay between the experts, the quote-unquote experts showing up can be significant. I never, setting up on a fire or an auto extrication or any of that stuff, I never thought about who I was turfing it to. It was mine, and I'm going to run it, you know. But I, in my mind, Phil, and you kind of – commented on this right at the very beginning. Own it. Own the thing. You got it. There will be people coming, but you got it. Set it up right. I think that right there is probably the biggest mental shift of, yeah, experts are coming, but who knows how long that's going to take with them being on other runs and across town and freeway and traffic and everything else. You got this, baby. Set it up in the best way you can and learn how to do that appropriately. That, to me, I think is the mental shift that might have to happen. So, hey, brother, you did a great job. Really appreciate it. Michael, go ahead.
No, thank you very much. It was great. I learned a lot. I think it was a great show. And I hope our listeners, got something out of this too. I think they should have if they paid attention. And I look forward to seeing you at FDIC. Brother, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys, and we'll see you in August.
Yeah, hey, Phil, we'll see you at FDIC, brother, for sure, if not before then. If they want to reach out to you to schedule a class or they want to ask you a question, you want them to go through Hazmat Nation, or do you got a better way to get a hold of you?
That's Hazmat Nation or HazSim, and, yeah, but me personally won't be going out and doing classes anytime necessarily soon. I've gone all in on my new job, and but I definitely have you know, there's people I know that can take care of what you need that are probably better than anything I can do. But absolutely, through Hazmat Nation, or if you're interested in looking at HazSim, take a look at that. We may have somebody that has a system near you, because not everybody can you know, it's not cheap to build something, especially the way we're doing it. And so we recognize that there are departments that, you know, can't necessarily run out and buy that training system. In fact, first thing I ever tell any of them is, do you have detection equipment? Because if you don't have that, get that first. But the IFF, they have several of our systems, and they use it as part of their training program going around the country. You know, if you want to get some of that good hands-on training, they're also somebody to contact. But I'm searchable online, so it shouldn't be too tough to track me down.
Very cool. We'll look through a list of bank robbers and all that kind of stuff. We'll find you, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, brother, hey, great job. I knew you would do a good job and really appreciate it. Take care down there in sunny SoCal, and we'll see you at FDIC.
All right. Take care, gentlemen. Keep enjoying retirement.
Okay.
Thank you.
Will do.
Bye-bye.
All right, Michael. Very good show. Tough topic. At least seems like a tough topic. And, man, what a humble, articulate dude that is. Good stuff.
Yeah, somebody you can learn a lot from, bro. Somebody you can learn a lot from. Which is a good thing.
Okay, well, yeah. Well, folks, we really appreciate you listening tonight. I hope you enjoyed the heck out of that like Mike and I did. You can get this on Fire Engineering Radio, Blog Talk Radio. It's going to be kept in the archive. Don't get frustrated if it doesn't pop up tonight. usually takes them about a day to, you know, feed the squirrels and get all the mechanisms running where the machine goes. But you can get this on archive, and it will be kept in perpetuity. Hope things are good out there, folks. I know it's been long months. Mike, at times I feel like we start to see the end of it, and then, boy, you know, now now I was starting to hear about upticks. I know your state's got an uptick. It feels like maybe we got at least a little bit more of this stuff to navigate, but I just want to encourage you that sense of accomplishment and feeling you feel when you hear people like Chief Ambrose talk about the joy of the job and about doing good at this. Brothers and sisters, you are meeting people at their very biggest need level, and they're just as frustrated as you. They're just as unsure and fearful about what the future holds, and you are meeting them at their very basic need level, and I hope you will feel a sense of accomplishment about that, and that you'll continue to look out for each other, to take care of each other, to not grow weary, as the good book would say, to not grow weary in doing good. And, you know, just stay after this thing, this blessed, beautiful calling that we have, and take care of each other. And if you know what, if you're starting to feel, if you feel the walls closing in, if you start to feel the darkness kind of overtaking the light, there are brothers and sisters all across this nation that are ready to chat with you. And, you know, don't let it get to be too much. And there's going to be a time when the sun comes out completely, and, you know, hopefully we're pretty close to that. At least that's my hope, Michael. That is my hope.
I think that sounds great, brother, because, I mean, I know we all are weary, but we just can't give up. We've come so far. We just can't give up. And let this re-overtake everything we've done so far. So my hope is that you just see you're clear of it. And as Michael said, if it's getting to you, reach out to somebody. There are a lot of people out there who are willing to listen, to help, to talk, and they want to be there for you. Reach out to them. You are not alone in this, and do not give in to the darkness right now. I mean, just continue fighting the fight, brothers and sisters, please, because it's something we have to do. And, you know, I hate to sound cliches, but we are in this together. We are in this together. Stay the course and take care of yourself. And let's keep moving forward. God bless you all. Thank you for listening.
Michael, that was good words. I will let that be the closeout. Brothers and sisters, thanks for hanging out with us again for another Mikey G and Mikey D show. We will see you, I don't know, we'll see you in about 5-6 weeks when we're next on the docket. God bless. Take care. And we'll see you then.